This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Over us. That's Yusuf Islam, who used to be known as the singer-songwriter Cat Stevens before he became a follower of Allah. Welcome to the Spiritual Classics of Islam on the Spirit of Things here on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. Allah is how Muslims refer to the one God, and Muhammad was his prophet. There are about 1.3 billion Muslims worldwide, and they're the majority population in 52 nations. Most of them would recite the Muslim scriptures, that is the Quran, in Arabic, as it is the sacred tongue. But if the Quran is a holy text, the question is, how should the numerous injunctions and commandments be applied today? My first guest has a method, which he set out in his new book, Interpreting the Quran, Towards a Contemporary Approach. He's Abdullah Saeed from Melbourne University, and he'll be with us in a moment. Later, we'll hear from a young American scholar, Reza Aslan, who takes us back to the religious melting pot of Mecca that formed the young Muhammad. And finally, the riveting story of a young woman who wanted to know the Quran and had to find out the hard way, the Canadian Muslim Irshad Manji.
He it is who has sent his messenger with the guidance and religion of truth, that he may exalt it above all religions, even though the pagans may detest it.
The Quran is the immutable word of God, according to Muslims, but its literal meaning can sometimes pose problems for the modern believer. And that's what Abdullah Saeed, who belongs to the majority Sunni tradition, has tackled in his several books on Islam. He's an advocate of a more flexible, modern approach to the interpretation of the Quran, and it's one of the subjects he teaches at the Centre for the Study of Contemporary Islam at the University of Melbourne. Abdullah Saeed, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Well, Abdullah, how did the Quran come into existence?
Well, for that we have to go back to the early 7th century Arabia. The Quran is for Muslims a revelation from God. And this revelation came from God to Prophet Muhammad, who was living in Mecca in Arabia at the time. It took 22 years for the revelation to be completed, from 610 to 632. So the texts we have in the Quran came at different points in time, in different situations, circumstances, right up to the death of the Prophet, which occurred in 632. At the time of the Prophet, the Quran was not put together in the form of a book. It was put together in the form of a book after his death, roughly within 20 years or so.
Well, revelation is certainly a mysterious process. Is it believed that Allah spoke Arabic to Muhammad?
Yes, Muslim theologians and philosophers discussed this in quite a bit of detail. Generally speaking, Muslims adopt dictation theory of revelation. God communicated his will in a language known to the Prophet, in this case Prophet Muhammad, in Arabic. either directly or indirectly through a medium. Generally speaking, Muslims consider this medium to be an angel, in particular, Angel Gabriel. So the revelation comes from God in the language the prophet understands, and in turn the prophet communicates that message in the same language to his people.
Is the suggestion that Muhammad might have written the Quran himself unthinkable to Muslims?
It is a very big problem for Muslims, partly because, or mainly because, Islam is based on the idea that God revealed his will to the prophet, in this case, Prophet Muhammad. And that revelation is in Arabic. And this is very much the foundation of Islam. If there is any suggestion that somehow the Quran in Arabic is written by Muhammad, it loses that authoritativeness. The authority is God, not the prophet himself. So if Muhammad had written the Quran and attributed to God falsely, basically the foundation of Islam just disappears. So it's a serious problem for Muslims.
Well, how would you describe the content and the organization of the Quran?
Let's look at the content first. The Quran talks about a lot of things. It talks about God, what we might call the unseen world, paradise and hell, life after death, what would happen, accountability, judgment, etc. It also talks about past prophets, Moses, Jesus, David, Solomon, also prophets for Muslims, Adam, etc., and their communities. It also talks about ethical and moral values. It has a lot of commandments and prohibitions. There are plenty of issues and themes and topics the Quran deals with. And these topics are not discussed in one particular sort of part of the Quran. In one chapter, it may discuss issues related to God, the prophet, some ethical and moral values, some of the things that were happening in the prophet's time in Mecca at the time. So it's very hard for someone who is not familiar with the Quran to go to the Quran and read through that and find all what he or she needs in relation to a particular topic. As far as the organization is concerned, the Quran is roughly the same size as the New Testament. It has 114 chapters of unequal length, arranged according to the length of the chapters. Those chapters at the beginning of the Quran are the longest, and those who are at the end are the shortest. For instance, chapter 2, which has something like 280 plus verses, is the longest chapter in the Quran, whereas one of the shortest chapters of 3 verses are towards the end of the Quran.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, Muslim scholars have discussed the issue of arrangement of the Quran. Usually they would say that this is very much the instruction of the prophet, but probably one could say that perhaps this is organized in this way for ease of recitation, but there is no definitive answer to that from Muslim theologians and scholars.
Recitation is a very important obligation of the Muslim. Is it more important than analyzing the text?
Recitation and analyzing are part of the same thing. Recitation is, of course, important because one has to recite the Quran at least 5 times a day in prayers or more. The vast majority of Muslims in the world are not Arabs. The Quran is Arabic, but still Muslims around the world, from West Africa to Southeast Asia, recite the Quran in Arabic. Many of them wouldn't understand what it means, but because it is considered to be the word of God, recitation is considered an important aspect of one's day-to-day life and to be a blessed act, so to speak. Analysis is, of course, for those who are knowledgeable of the language, the tradition, the text, the interpretation, methodology, principles, etc. It is for those people analysis, I guess, is important. Of course, one has to analyze the Quran in order to understand what exactly God wants from us. And without analysis, one would not have what is called Islamic law, ethics, norms, etc. And all these are based on an analysis of the Quranic text.
Well, in your analysis of the Quran, you focused on what you've called ethico-legal teachings. Why did you focus on them?
These texts are related to the laws, rules, regulations, norms, values, etc., which are important for the functioning of the society and also important for a Muslim how to interact with the rest of the Muslim community or the rest of the community in general. And it seems to me that unless we tackle this particular text type and find appropriate means of dealing with this text type, it will be very hard for us to discuss the relationship of the Quran and Quranic norms and values, rules and regulations to contemporary concerns and needs of Muslims today. One of the texts we could look at in this context is perhaps those that are related to women. The Quran says, for instance, men are maintainers of women. Of course, the verse goes on to say why that should be the case. Now, this is a good example of an ethical legal text. The question is, how do we approach this text in the contemporary world? In the 7th century Arabia, yes, men were maintainers of women because they spent on the family, the men used to earn, and women did not usually take the financial responsibility for the family, etc. But what happens if the situation changes? What happens when the society is such that women have opportunities for work, earning, education, etc., and they also become contributors to the family through their wealth? And if that's the case, well, one has to come up with some understanding of how to deal with the text in the contemporary world.
Well, that approach that you've just outlined is what you've called the contextualist approach. How does that compare to the traditionalist approach to that text? And can you read it for us?
Historically, when Muslim scholars interpreted the Quran, they relied on purely linguistic criteria, meaning that you read the text, you look at the meaning of the words, syntax, grammar, and then arrive at an understanding of the text. And that understanding becomes the basis for any rules and regulations one is going to derive from that. There are certain limitations of that approach. You're not actually relating a particular ruling to the context of the 7th century Mecca and Medina and Arabia in general. And if you're not doing that, and you're generalizing that ruling to every single situation that would come after the 7th century in different societies, different circumstances, well, if the society changes, if the circumstances change, then you're still trying to apply a ruling that is purely based on linguistic criteria without any regard to contextual elements. With the contextualist approach, you're going beyond the linguistic criteria. Of course, you're relying on the linguistic criteria to understand the meaning of the text. That has to be the basis. But from that, you're moving to an understanding of the context of this text in the 7th century Arabia, and try to see what were the role of men and women in the society, etc. And then come into the modern period and see what sort of similarities and differences are there between that society and our society today. If there are lots of similarities, then of course one would extend that ruling to the contemporary context. But if the situation has changed dramatically, then one would say perhaps this ruling might not apply to this particular society of today. Well, the verse in Arabic reads, الرجال قوامون على النساء بما فضل الله بعضهم على بعض وبما أنفقوا. What it means is that men are maintainers of women because God has given certain advantages for some over the others and because of what they spend.
Also part of that surah, however, is the injunction that when a woman, a wife, is not obedient, she can be reprimanded. And I think there are a number of things that he can do, including beating her. Now, that's the verse that is often cited by feminists as unacceptable in its literal meaning.
That section actually reads, وَاللَّاتِ تَخَافُونَ نُشُوزَهُنَّ فَعِذُوهُنَّ وَهْجُرُوهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ وَاضْرِبُوهُنَّ فَيْنَطَعْنَكُمْ فَلَا تَبْغُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ سَبِيلًا.
So men are the maintainers of women because Allah has made some of them to excel others and because they spend out of their property. The good women are therefore obedient, guarding the unseen as Allah has guarded. And as to those on whose part you fear desertion, admonish them and leave them alone in the sleeping places and beat them. Then, if they obey you, do not seek a way against them. Surely Allah is high and great. That's the contentious Surah 434 from the Quran, often cited in books on women and Islam. Abdullah Saeed is my guest on the Spiritual Classics of Islam, the fifth in our series that looks at the sacred texts of the world's religions. You're tuned to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. Abdullah is the director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary Islam at the University of Melbourne. Do you find any precedent in the tradition for this contextualist approach or this more flexible approach to interpretation of the Quran?
Yes, I do. There are plenty of precedents for this in the very early period of Islam, particularly in the time of the Prophet and also the first generation of Muslims and the second generation of Muslims. We are talking about the 7th century. Let me just give one example here. One of the very famous verses of the Quran is related to the issue of zakat, which is a compulsory charity, so to speak, which Muslims are supposed to pay for the community benefits, etc. This particular verse says that there are 8 categories of recipients of zakat, and one of the categories is people who are converts to Islam or people who whose allegiance to the Muslim community was important. Now, the Prophet actually gave a share of zakat to these people. And similarly, his immediate successor, Abu Bakr, gave a share of zakat to those people. But the second successor to the Prophet, whose name is Umar ibn al-Khattab, or the second caliph, flatly refused to give any share of zakat to these people when they came demanding the share of zakat from him. He said Islam during the time of the Prophet and during the time of Abu Bakr was relatively weak. Now Islam is strong, and we don't need your support or allegiance to the Muslim community, and I'm not going to give you any share of zakat. Now, Umar here is going very much against a very clearly spelled out Quranic commandment, so to speak. This is zakat, which is one of the pillars of Islam, and the categories of recipients are very clearly spelled out in the Quran. But Umar is saying things were different in those days, but things have changed now. So I'm not going to give any share of zakat, even though the Quran very clearly says so, even though the Prophet himself actually gave a share of zakat to these people. Now, this is a very clear example of how very early Muslims managed to deal with ethico-legal texts and relating that to their context.
Well, Abdullah, you are a university academic. You're comfortable with notions of history and sociology. You're a scholar and also a layman. What kind of authority do you have in matters of Islamic law and practice in the community today? Isn't this the domain of imams?
Well, at least within the Sunni Islam, there is no hierarchy of people who could talk about these issues. The key issue is whether you have adequate knowledge, skills, and ability to deal with the text and the tradition, your familiarity with principles of exegesis, jurisprudence, your understanding of theology, philosophy. It's basically the knowledge base you have which matters. As far as imams are concerned, imams can be anything from just a prayer leader to someone who has, you know, in-depth knowledge of Islamic scholarship. Not every prayer leader has that. As far as the acceptability of the views I put forward, well, it's up to the community to accept or not accept. These issues I'm talking about are discussed and debated widely among Muslims right throughout the Muslim world. So this is not a localized debate. This is a global debate in which Muslim scholars from the US to Egypt to Iran to Indonesia to Australia are involved in. Of course, there is opposition to these new ideas, and that's expected in any religious tradition if you put forward new ideas. But right throughout Islamic history, you had scholars and thinkers putting forward new ideas, initially opposed, then becomes part of the accepted tradition. And I don't think what we are seeing today in the Muslim world in relation to opposition to these new ideas is anything new. And diverse opinions are always part and parcel of the accepted tradition of Islam.
The shape of things to come in Islam in the West. Abdullah Saeed, thank you so much for illuminating one of the world's sacred texts.
Thank you very much.
Abdullah Saeed is the author of Interpreting the Quran Towards a Contemporary Approach. You can find book details and a transcript later in the week on our New Look website at abc.net.au/religion and follow the prompts to the spirit of things. And while you're there, drop me an email telling me what you think about our new website and, of course, our program. I'd love to hear your comments.
قل هو الله أحد الله الصمد لم يلد ولم يولد ولم يكن له كفوا أحد.
Say, He is Allah, the One, Allah, the Eternal, Absolute. He begets not, nor was he begotten, and there is none comparable to him.
It's said that when Muhammad called the tribal chiefs to submit to the one and only God, they became enraged. But according to the American historian of Islam, Reza Aslan, the people of Mecca would have been no strangers to monotheism. Reza, who was born in Iran, has written a book that's attracted much praise, which is pretty impressive since it's his first. No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam begins with Muhammad in Mecca, where he mingled with the local Jews and Christians who traced their faith back to Abraham. Reza Aslan is speaking to me from New York.
Can we assume that Muhammad read some of the books that belong to the Jews and Christians?
No, I don't think Muhammad would have read either of those books because he couldn't read either Greek or Hebrew. But you're absolutely right. Mecca was, at this time, in the 6th century, a cosmopolitan city full of different cultures and ethnicities, brimming with religious traditions, whether they be Jews or whether they be Christians in all of its various varieties of Christianity, or whether it be pagans in all of those varieties. There were Zoroastrians, which of course is the pre-Islamic religion of Iran, a very powerful religion at the time. And then there was a lot of religious experimentation in this city as well, sort of a melting pot of religions. And perhaps the most exciting religious innovation was this distinctly Arab monotheistic movement that was based neither on Christianity nor Judaism nor Zoroastrianism, for that matter, but was an attempt to create a national monotheistic identity that traced its origins back to the teachings of Abraham.
Now, would that have been the content of Muhammad's first revelation when he was in the cave?
These followers of this Arabian monotheism that I was referring to refer to themselves as the Hanifs. And there is some evidence in the earliest traditions that Muhammad was not just aware of the Hanifs, but would have been very familiar with their teachings. And if you look at the Quran, you see over and over again this attempt to acknowledge Abraham as the founder of this revelation, of this new ideal, this new faith that is being preached. Over and over again, the Quran talks about the religion of Abraham and about returning to the religion of Abraham. And that's precisely what the Hanifs preach. So it seems very clear that Muhammad, you know, grew up in an area and in an era in which he had no choice but to be profoundly affected by the religious traditions around him. Just a simple glance at the Quran indicates some familiarity with the great myths and stories of the Torah. The gospel story of Jesus is presented in the Quran in somewhat of an abridged form. And all of these stories are presented as though the audience should already be familiar with them. So, for instance, before talking about the story of Joseph, the Quran begins, "Remember what happened to Joseph." When it talks about Abraham, it says, "As you recall what happened to Abraham." And so, in other words, there is this understanding embedded in the Quran that the original audience for this revelation was already familiar with a lot of these stories, probably because they were surrounded by them. They were in the ether, if you will.
So did he feel he was bringing a new message or simply renewing an old one?
I think Muhammad could not have been more clear, and the Quran itself could not be more clear about the fact that this was not in any way a new message. Over and over again, the Quran states, what you are hearing is not new. It's the same message that was given to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and to all the tribes of Israel. It's the same message that was given to Jesus and to John the Baptist. Their God is your God. Their message, their scripture is your message, your scripture. The only difference is that this time, this message, this old ancient message, is being given to what the Quran refers to as a people without a book, in other words, the Arabs. But there was never an attempt in the Prophet's lifetime to delineate this message as something new. And I think that there is even some evidence, if you look at the historical traditions, that in Muhammad's lifetime again, that there was never really any attempt to think of this movement as a wholly new religion, but as very much a part of the Judeo-Christian biblical prophetic tradition that most people are very familiar with.
Is that what is meant in the second surah, verse 285, which says, we make no difference between any of his apostles, that is, God's apostles? Is he saying, I'm like all the apostles before me?
That's absolutely what he's saying, is that he understood his role as being part of this line of prophets from Adam, according to the Quran, all the way down to Muhammad, who later on in Islamic history becomes known as the seal of the prophets. Muhammad felt very much a part of this lineage, and that his role essentially was to reveal a portion of this divine message to the Arab people. The Quran talks about this very interesting phenomenon called the Umm al-Kitab, or the Mother of Books. And essentially what this means is that in heaven, at the right hand of God, is this master text, this master scripture from which all of the world's revelations are derived. The Quran is essentially part of that revelation. Now, Muslims believe it's the perfection of that revelation, but nonetheless, it's not meant to cancel out or annul previous revelations. It is meant to simply perfect them. And again, this constant awareness that there is nothing new in what is being preached, that this is a reminder to people of the religion of Abraham and how to return to that original ideal.
What happened to Muhammad in the cave? What caused him to tremble so?
Well, according to tradition, in 610 AD, Muhammad was sitting in a cave meditating on Mount Hira. This was a common practice for a lot of people at that time, and it seemed to have been a common practice of Muhammad's. We have stories about him repeatedly going off on these spiritual retreats, times of meditation and fasting and concentration, and with some kind of charitable act, either sacrificing some animal and giving the meat to the poor or dispensing some kind of wealth or whatever the case may be. This was a pagan tradition and a common one that Muhammad exercised quite often. Well, during one of these experiences, one of these retreats, while he was sitting in this cave, meditating upon not just God, but upon the social iniquities of the Mecca in which he lived, he had a prophetic experience. And what the traditions talk about is this sudden feeling of being locked in a terrifying embrace in which his very breath is squeezed out of him. Some traditions say that he actually saw these words. Some traditions say that he heard these words. Some traditions talk about these words being stamped upon his heart. But he hears a voice commanding him to recite. Like most prophets, he has no idea what this means and certainly wants nothing to do with it. And so he replies, what should I recite? And again, the voice repeats this commandment, recite. Again, Muhammad in his confusion blurts out, I don't know what to recite. What is it that I should recite? And then suddenly the very first words of revelation come upon him, recite in the name of your God, your Lord, who has created humanity out of a clot of blood. Recite, for your Lord is the all-knowing. It is God who has taught humanity what it did not know. That first revelation becomes essentially Muhammad's burning bush, and it is that moment in time in which he ceases to be simply another Meccan businessman, another merchant concerned with society's ills, and becomes what in the Western religious traditions is referred to as prophet.
You've mentioned the burning bush, and I want to ask you whether there are some clear borrowings or continuities between the Old Testament and the Quran. I wonder, for example, the first or the second surah, which is called the Cow, which is golden. Is that a reference or an echo from the golden calf in the book of Exodus?
Absolutely it is, and it is only one of many, many allusions and references to the Hebrew scriptures. There are others. So, for instance, the description that we find in the Quran of heaven, of paradise, is very much related to some of the descriptions that we see in the Hebrew Bible. The way that the Quran refers to certain stories about the great prophets of the past can be almost lifted from the pages of the Hebrew scriptures. And this again shows that these stories were all around, that the Arabs were so integrated with the pagan Arabs, I should say, were so integrated with their Christian and Jewish and Zoroastrian neighbors that they saw these stories as simply another way of expressing similar spiritual values. I think that the most important thing to keep in mind when comparing the Quran with, say, the Torah or the Gospels, and especially in the similarities of language, is not so much that one borrowed from the other. It's that these were very common ways of expressing this inexpressible experience of the divine.
Reza Aslan is my guest, the author of No God But God, and he's speaking to me about the religious currents that surrounded Muhammad in Mecca and later Medina. In fact, in a couple of weeks, you can hear more about Muhammad the Man on The Ark, Sunday afternoons at 3:45 and Wednesday evenings at 8:35, so keep an ear out for it. You're with The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, the fifth in our Spiritual Classics series. This week, the holy texts of Islam, including the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet. Now, when Muhammad died, who compiled the Quran?
Well, the Quran wasn't compiled or canonized as we know it for many years later. It was actually under the caliphate of Uthman, who was the third caliph. The first successor of the Prophet Muhammad was Abu Bakr. The second was Umar. And the third was Uthman. And Uthman was the first person to decide that rather than having the Quran being passed around orally as it was, and I should emphasize that even during the Prophet's lifetime, some verses, especially those dealing with legal matters, were written down. They were written on scraps of parchment or on the spines of palm leaves or sometimes on camel bones. Most of the revelation was memorized. It was memorized by a class of memorizers called the Qurra. Their job essentially was to absorb these verses from the Prophet Muhammad and then put them to memory, and then they became sort of the walking Qurans. They would go from city to city preaching this message that was being brought down from heaven and poured out of the Prophet's lips. They, at the end of the Prophet's life, essentially become the sources of the traditions. And by the time we get to the Caliphate of Uthman, many of these people are starting to die. A lot of the early companions are passing away. And I think Uthman made a strategic decision at that point that it's time not just to put all of this down in writing in a single text, but to make sure that that text becomes the sole text. And so after canonizing the Quran, he made a concerted effort to collect whatever written Qurans there were in the outlying provinces in Basra or in Egypt, and to bring them back to Medina, the center of the Muslim community, and to destroy them.
But the Quran wouldn't be the only source of tradition. There were these other collections of sayings called the Hadith. Who put them together?
The Hadith are a collection of the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad, and they were collected even during the Prophet's lifetime. We have to understand that the Quran is not like, say, the Hebrew Bible. It is not a series of books. It doesn't have a lot of stories and narratives to it. It's not like the Gospels insofar as it doesn't tell the story of Muhammad. In fact, Muhammad is barely mentioned in the Quran, nor does it tell the story of the early Muslim movement. The Quran is essentially God's dramatic monologue. It is simply God speaking to humanity. As such, it is a wonderful book to serve as a guidebook for morality and human conduct, but insofar as running an empire or a state, it is really lacking. And so what arose after the Prophet's death was almost a parallel tradition to the Quran of these hadith, these anecdotal stories about the Prophet. Now, the problem with the hadith, of course, is there was no regulation to them. There was no mechanism by which they could be verified at this time. So essentially, anyone could make up any hadith, any story of the Prophet, in order to justify any idea that they had. And by around the 10th century or so, so let's say about 200-300 years after the death of the Prophet, the 9th, 10th centuries, there were some 700,000 of these hadiths floating around the Muslim world. The vast, vast majority of them obviously fabricated in order to essentially legitimize common practices. Many of them were lifted from other sources. One famous hadith was essentially a word-for-word rendition of the Lord's Prayer. There were a lot of Persian maxims, some verses from the Bhagavad Gita and from other Indian sources, the Vedas. So again, it became very important to figure out a way to strip as best as possible the hadiths from all of their falseness, all their fabrications, and to create some kind of legitimizing canon. That attempt was done independently by a number of different scholars who sifted through these traditions, and by trying to connect the traditions as closely as they could to the earliest followers of Muhammad, made essentially a hierarchy of the hadith that are most sound, the ones that are not as sound, and those that are unsound and unreliable completely. And that has essentially become the four or five collections that we have today of these hadith. In fact, there is a lot of discussion and controversy about whose collection of hadiths is the most sound. The Shia, of course, have their own collection of hadith that is quite different from the various Sunni hadiths. There are a couple of fairly well-established ones, like, for instance, the collection by al-Bukhari. But even so, I think it's important to understand that there was no scientific historical process through which these hadiths were formalized and authenticated. The way that they were authenticated is through their line of transmission. So in other words, if one particular anecdote was linked to someone who knew someone else, who heard it from someone else, who heard it from someone else, who heard it from the Prophet Muhammad, then therefore it was a sound tradition. That, I think, we would understand in the modern world would not really pass the test of history. And indeed, many of these hadiths contradict each other. Many of them contradict the Quran. And so they don't become a very valuable source for understanding Islam in the time of the Prophet Muhammad. However, they become an incredibly valuable source in understanding Islam in the time in which these hadiths were collected. In other words, what really made someone decide whether a hadith was sound or not is whether it could be reconciled to the majority practices that were already accepted and understood in the Islamic world by around the 9th or 10th century. So in many ways, the Hadith are Islam's attempt to create some measure of orthodoxy.
Not easy to accomplish, however, when there were so many competing Hadith. That was Iranian-born Reza Aslan, who's based in Los Angeles and is affiliated with the University of Southern California. And don't forget to go to our website at abc.net.au/religion and click the link to The Spirit of Things to find out book details and also to listen to the program online. Or if you're really up to the new technology, there are step-by-step instructions on how to download this program as a podcast. Irshad Manji may send shivers down the spine of traditionalists, but her story of how she struggled in a patriarchal madrasa or religious school to find out what the Quran actually says rings bells with a lot of people, especially women. A Canadian Muslim who's known around the world for her frank disclosure of the contradictions in the holy text, Irshad sees in them an opportunity for change. Irshad, when you were young and in the madrasa, were you taught to remember to recite the Quran?
Recitation was everything. Analysis, thinking, questioning, nothing. Now, let me backtrack. When I grew up in the madrasa, the Islamic religious school just outside of Vancouver, I asked plenty of questions. So why can't girls lead prayer? I think was my first one. Then, you know, sir, I said to my madrasa teacher, you say that the Quran came to Prophet Muhammad as a message of peace. Why, even after receiving that message, did he command his army to slay an entire Jewish tribe? All of these questions were met with a grimace, of course, but also with the standard answer, read the Quran, it's all there. And two things. One was that, you know, in a family that was struggling to integrate into the West, Arabic study did not rank as a high priority in my family. So the Quran at that point was only ever presented to me in Arabic. And there was a reason for that. The point was not to understand it, but merely to commit it to memory. So it was totally rote. However, not satisfied with simply doing that, I then went out and tried to find an English language translation of the Quran, something that nobody had told me existed. I just figured maybe something like that is available. And indeed it was. So I began reading the Quran on my own and realized that the so-called answers in the Quran were not there at all. Not because the Quran is a worthless document, of course, but because the Quran, like all of the holy books, contains contradictions, ambiguities, and inconsistencies. And I realized that there is a much more fluid way of approaching the Quran than what I was being indoctrinated with. In some ways, that freedom to read it on my own terms and to begin appreciating it at my own pace actually saved my faith in my faith.
Were you able to go to books that did critically analyze the Quran? Are there many publications that a person like you could go to?
Post 9/11, there certainly are. But at the time that I was struggling with this and going to the public library and devouring as many commentaries as I possibly could, both about the Quran and about Islam in general, not only was there not, you know, a great deal to ingest, but also this was a time, 15 years ago, when Salman Rushdie, author of the Satanic Verses, had received his now infamous death warrant. And as a result, there was a spurt of commentary about the Quran and Islam. However, most of those commentaries that I came across were only satisfied to explain why so many Muslims are angry about the Satanic Verses. Not a single one that I can remember went as far as questioning whether the Quran is as pristine, as virgin, as untouched as the effigy burners would have us believe. That was when I began to realize that the intellectually messy West in which I grew up may very well be losing its brain power. In this fit of multicultural sensitivity, we had forgotten to ask the more basic questions.
And are Muslims today now asking some of those basic questions of the Quran, that is, its historical development, its relationship to other texts, its evolution?
There is a lot of underground study going on, but the vast majority of young Muslims from whom I hear tell me that they are still afraid of the persecution, by which they mean physical violence against themselves and their families, if they do openly question the origins of the Quran and the historical construction of this book. On the flip side, I am very excited to report that there are at least a handful of young Muslims in the United States who are working together on what they call the reformist translation of the Quran, and they hope to actually bring that out in the next year or two. So some underground movement, and enough to give me hope, but certainly not an explosion of it.
Of course, many imams or spiritual teachers would say that the ambiguity in the Quran affords a degree of latitude of interpretation.
Sure, no question about that. And I would go a step further, that not only are some passages ambiguous and open to interpretation, but that, you know, entire sections of the Quran are at war with one another over, you know, women's equality or religious pluralism and so forth. When it comes to religious diversity, for example, the Quran, in fact, does advise Muslims not to take Jews and Christians as friends, lest we become one of them. It describes them as an unjust people whom God does not guide. There's talk of smiting and slaughtering and slavery, and even subjecting non-Muslims to a special tax as a tribute to their Muslim conquerors. On the other hand, the Quran also heaps affection on Prophet Abraham, grandfather of the three monotheisms. The Quran describes Jesus as the Messiah, and more than once. Christ's mother Mary gets several positive mentions, and this is interesting, the Quran even describes the Jews as the exalted nation. In fact, in a couple of separate passages, it vindicates the sovereign role of Jews in the Holy Land. Now, you know what all of this contradiction means? That Muslims who wish to live by the book have no choice but to make choices about what to emphasize and what to downplay. Selectiveness is inevitable, which is the main reason why Muslims ought to be respectfully suspicious of the verses that are handed to them by their imams and mullahs. Any verse that is offered up as the definitive verse that pronounces on any particular issue will likely have a contradictory verse in the Quran as well. It is therefore up to all of us and each of us to decide what is our moral filter, why, and how will that evolve. For all of the contradictions I've just described, there are nonetheless three key messages in the Quran that leap out at me from beginning to middle to end. The first message is, only God knows fully the truth of anything. Second, God alone can punish disbelief, which makes sense given that only God knows fully the truth of anything. And finally, as a result of those two messages, the third one is that Muslims must have the humility to be open to freedom of exploration. And freedom of exploration not just for ourselves, but for everyone. Why? Here's the kicker. Because anything less undermines God's jurisdiction as the supreme judge and jury. This is the principle on which monotheism is based. Now, who am I to be corrupting monotheism?
Irshad Manji is a Canadian Muslim whose book, The Trouble with Islam Today, was published to great acclaim and controversy. The Spiritual Classics of Islam was produced by me and Jeff Wood, and our sound engineer was Roy Huberman. Check out our New Look website at abc.net.au/religion for all the editions of the Spiritual Classics series, which are aired on the last Sunday of the month. There are more to come, so stay tuned. Next week, the world-renowned fertility expert, Lord Robert Winston, known to audiences for his BBC TV series, The Human Body and Superhuman. Having conquered the body, he wanted to explore the soul and write the story of God. That's Lord Robert Winston, from Gynecology to God on The Spirit of Things, here on ABC Radio National, with me, Rachel Kahn. Thank you.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.